You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and joining you on April the 2nd, 2024, the date from which the much lampooned Specialized Head Sock or TT Super Snood loss sported by Primoz Roglic in the Basque Country yesterday will be outlawed. My name's Daniel Freiber. I am the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we'll don our fully authorized scuba caps and dive deep back into the slightly opaque waters of Sunday's Tour of Flanders, into Paris-Roubaix's form guide, and also into what awaits us later in the week in northern Spain. Mitch Docker, last week we started off the podcast talking about haircuts. Today we're rolling down the start ramp talking about headgear. Are you sad? Did you know the Super Snood is gone, Mitch? The head sock gone from today?
I didn't know, and I'm not too sad about it, on a fashion police style. I think I want to get it back to when they just had the plastic lids on, you know, back in the Ulrich Armstrong days. They're just like those super skinny lids. They were so quick, those.
One of my favorite sort of TT headgear moment, when I watch it back now, 1996 Tour de France, last time trial, Saint-Emilion, where Jan Ulrich famously won, beat Miguel Indurain. So he's wearing just a casquette on the start ramp. And sort of 1 second as they're counting down, and it goes 3, 2, and sort of on 2 seconds, he sort of has this moment where he thinks, oh, no, I'll turn it around. It looks better. It looks better facing the other way.
I love that. It's just like not even concerned about, you know, the start, taking the big deep breaths. He's like, you know what? I might just do the style cap adjustment. 1 second to go. It's like a switch. Click. Yeah. And I'm ready.
Yeah. Well, listen, it worked. Also joining us today is the immaculately coiffured as ever, young Richard Abraham.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Daniel. I do make an effort. I know it's all theatre of the mind and that, but I'm glad listeners can get a sense of what's going on.
No.
How are you, Daniel? You all right?
Very good. I am also helmetless, headbandless, super snoodless. The alien helmets, incidentally, again, didn't work yesterday. Who knows whether they worked or not. But Jonas Vingegaard, well, we'll talk about this in a minute. He didn't win the opening day time trial in the Basque Country, and the alien Visma Lisa bike helmets yet to trouble the scorers, yet to get off the mark as far as winning time trials is concerned. Anyway,
wonder what would happen if they weren't wearing them then, how far back they'd be.
But no further news from the UCI over whether or on whether they will be outlawed. There was a Visma Lisa bike rider who didn't wear one in his time trial the other day.
I did see that a couple in Basque Country opted not to. I mean, looking at that race, it was a lot of racing through cobbled streets, windy roads, and you think, like, well, if you've got a huge kind of a lot of plastic around your head, maybe visibility or maneuverability isn't really a priority there. And
Primoz Roglic certainly, well, I don't know whether it was something affecting his visibility, but he certainly became slightly disoriented in the closing meters of that opening time trial in the Basque Country, as we'll find out. Well, let's find out now, shall we, Richard? It's over to you for the weekly news roundup.
Yeah, should we carry on with the Basque Country? Well, Daniel, you said Super Six, is it Fantastic Four? The three of them are there at Itzulia Basque Country: Primoz, Remco, and Jonas Vingegaard. And Juan Ayuso, maybe the sort of fifth Beatle, or, you know, as we'll come on to up there, maybe in that Fantastic Four. That's 5 time trial wins for Primoz Roglic in the Basque Country. If he starts a Basque Country time trial, he wins it. So he drew first blood there. Remco in the top 10, but he crashed early on and lost about 10 seconds or so. Another rider who crashed, Tom Pidcock, he crashed in the warm-up, and we had this extraordinary sight of him being sort of fireman lifted out of the Ineos team bus, but no severe injuries for him. He didn't take to the start, but I don't think any sort of serious effect on his spring.
Shades of Matt White in the 2004 Tour de France, Mitch. When he crashed out on a recon, over a TV cable. And also shades, well, it's a It's a bit of a haul of infamy or misfortune, isn't it? Riders who have crashed out on Recon's TTs. The most famous one, I suppose, Chris Froome in the Dauphiné in 2019 with disastrous consequences.
Yeah, Pidcock looked all right. It was, yeah, very strange to see him sort of being lifted off the team bus. But there we go. Well, that time trial kind of had everything, really. There was hail, there was rain, there was huge fans, there was Primoz Roglic going the wrong way at the finish, turning his TT bike on a sixpence. He kind of went down the deviation that they send the vehicles down just 20 metres or so before the line. I'm not sure how he did that, but it didn't cost him the victory. So Primoz obviously coming back in pretty good form, I'd say, after a disappointing Paris-Nice, not where he wanted to be. Looking ahead for that race, I was kind of looking for like the hilly stage, but I mean, they're all hilly. It's the Basque Country. They do sort of get progressively hillier. Saturday, the final stage, I think, is the Queen stage around Eibar. No summit finishes on this race, which is sort of typical for the Basque Country, isn't it? Low hills, short, steep.
Yeah, I was looking at this, Richard. There has been a bit of a murmur, hasn't there, about it not being the hardest for the Basque Country, but there is a lot of climbing. Thursday to Legutio is pretty tough. Friday to Morebieta with the Urquiola early in the stage. And then, as you say, Saturday, we haven't got the traditional finish on Arate above Eibar, but it does go over the hard way up Eibar, the Krabbelin side midway through the stage, and then the Itthua climb near the end. So, I don't know, it's a sort of pretty compelling canvas. Often when you get races that don't look as hard on paper or as sort of intimidatingly hard, it yields better racing. Sort of leaves you guessing as to where the real action is going to occur, but I'm sure there will be plenty of exciting action over the next few days.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I guess time stamping this is the Tuesday. We're sort of in the eye of the storm of the cobbled monuments, aren't we? Flanders and Roubaix. Flanders has just finished. Suffice to say, that was a Mathieu van der Poel show in the men's race. He won that pretty convincingly. Luca Mazzato second and Niels Pollitt third. Not Michael Matthews. He was relegated from the sprint, having initially finished third. Slightly controversially, perhaps. Maybe we'll come on to this. In the women's race, Elisa Longo-Borghini took a second victory in Flanders in her career. Kasia Navia-Doma second and Shirin van Anrooy third. Koppenberg decisive in that race as well as it was in the men. I think there are a couple of Arrivate episodes I'm going to sort of telegraph and point listeners to. If you do want some more analysis of exactly what happened and when, Daniel, you and I ran through the men's Tour of Flanders. Spoke about Cyrillic alphabets and called riders tactically naive. And
you called riders tactically naive.
It was their tactics that were naive. Just specify that, not the riders. Rose and Denny did the Arrivate for the women's race as well. So go and check those out if you want some more info there and some more detail. Earlier on in the week, there was the Dwarsdorf Vlaanderen. I think as relevant for the crash that took out the likes of Wout van Aert, Mads Pedersen, Jasper Stuyven, as it was for Matteo Jorgensen winning. Van Aert, of course, it sort of turned into a Belgian outpouring of public grief and mourning almost the day after the race. Broken ribs, broken sternum, and a broken collarbone for Van Aert, who's, well, he's out of Roubaix, probably not going to the Giro by the looks of it, and we'll wait and see just how his recovery goes there.
Charles, did you see that Red Bull had created a giant get well soon card? It was somewhere in the vicinity of the start or finish in Flanders at the weekend that punters were welcomed, were invited to sign on behalf of themselves and Red Bull. Meanwhile, Wout van Aert was enjoying some fritters, some chips at home, wasn't he? He posted on his Instagram that he spent Sunday, with a giant bowl of chips.
They're great recovery food, aren't they? Chips, yeah. Full of collagen and calcium, probably.
Is that so?
maybe, I don't know. Well, let's talk about the women's race, Dwarsdorf Vlaanderen. 250th career win for Marianne Vos, which is remarkable achievement. I looked up to see when her first one was. 2006 was her first career win. Astonishing for Marianne Vos. A double win for Visma Lisa bike there, Twice Door Vlaanderen. A couple of other results to tell you about this week, perhaps relevant with the Ardennes Classics sort of on the horizon. Brandon McNulty won the GP Indurain, and Benoît Cosnefroy won Paris Camembert. Probably both riders we're going to see a bit more of in the Ardennes. Is McNulty going to the Ardennes? I'm assuming he would be for UAE Team Emirates.
Yeah, he's had a pretty thick program so far, but he has. I'm fairly sure that he will be going to the Ardennes Classics, yeah.
Yeah. And another result, 29th for Mark Cavendish in the Nick Corkill Memorial Race. Did you guys see this?
Yes.
Well,
yes, go on.
Well, a great story. Top 30 for Cav. It's not his best result of the year, let's say. But it's perhaps not been the spring he would have wanted either. A great story. I think first reported by Tom Davidson at Cycling Weekly. Cav was back home on the Isle of Man, and the night before a local race, he sent a few messages, put in a late entry. The organisers kind of have this rule, I think, where they, you know, you're allowed to enter on the line essentially, but only if you're a World Tour or a, you know, pro team rider. Like, you know, you're allowed to skip the paperwork. Cav rocks up, and part of his training just went round this local race. I mean, that's kind of, you know, being slightly facetious here about his 29th place. It's, you know, it's part of his training, but. Kind of one of those
disappointing results.
Well, there are a few quotes from some of the riders. I mean, go and read the full story.
Borderline embarrassing.
What's Astana saying about all this? They wouldn't be happy.
Well, Morkov was busy, I think, probably prepping for Flanders, right? Case Bol. They didn't have the full lead out going. There is a quote from one of the competitors. He says, "From the gun, he, Cav, you know, was very vocal with the other riders. He made sure they were pulling their turn." So, you know, it sounds like it was the real Cav. But yeah, one of those kind of, every now and again you get those stories, don't you, of, you know, it's like playing on Wembley, the intersection of local club riders and possibly one of, if not the most famous cyclist at the moment.
The most famous sort of ringer story in professional cycling was maybe Pantani. Can you remember the story about Pantani turning up in a wig, which actually does kind of mimic your hairdo, Mitch? I think in a full sort of... I think there are pictures of this. You'll probably be able to find them on the internet somewhere. In like a full leotard, like a full sort of 1980s aerobic, full body leotard. And I want to say it was like a purple, long-haired purple wig. And he did some sort of local race near Cesenatico. I think this was when he was recovering from one of his injuries.
It makes me think of Jan Ulrich turning up as, was it Max Kraft, his pseudonym? It wasn't a race though, was it? It was Gran Fondo.
It was Gran Fondo in Italy, yeah.
Max, what's the translation of that? Max Power, isn't it?
Max Power.
Anyway, there we go. Yeah, Cav's next racing in the Tour of Turkey and the Tour of Hungary towards the end of April. So that's when we'll next see him in action. Well, not televised, the Mark Corkill Memorial Race, unfortunately. So we'll next see him on the TV in Turkey. A bit of other news. If you're wondering what happened to Arnaud Delis, absent from the Spring Classics, he's been diagnosed with Lyme disease, which perhaps accounts for his slightly subpar performances. Sorry, this spring. And if you're wondering what's happened to Franck Bonnamore, well, he's been sacked. He's been sacked from Decathlon Agie d'Auxerre following notification of abnormalities in his anti-doping biological passport. Bonnamore was actually suspended by the UCI in February. According to Decathlon, the suspension followed checks carried out before his arrival in the team on January the 1st, 2023. It's kind of interesting that it's taken so long for this to sort of, for a suspension to kick in, with my first thoughts on that. If we're talking about results or passport abnormalities that are 18 months old, quite sort of notable that this is, the suspension took that long to come through the pipeline. Bonnamore, known for, well, he won the Super Combativity in the 2021 Tour when he was riding for B&B Hotels.
Does that conclude the news roundup?
That concludes the news roundup, Daniel.
Well, chaps, I promised that we would be revisiting Tour of Flanders. Tour of Flanders that Mitch told me on a voicemail, message, WhatsApp message, was an absolute stinker, 0 stars out of 5 edition. That was the gist, wasn't it, Mitch?
Oh,
you weren't too impressed with
it. I love that if you don't know someone, you're like, is he being sarcastic? Is he seeing something, not understanding what I am? I'm assuming you knew I was being completely sarcastic.
Somewhat.
It was a great race. I love the classics, as everyone knows. And it could have been sunny and just sort of somewhat procession race, and I still would have loved it. But it wasn't. It was very much not that. It kicked off super early with Visma Lisa Bike doing some amazing attacks very early on the Wolfenberg. But then the rain came, and I was lucky enough to be commentating the race for the Australian broadcast at SBS. And I said very early on, I was like, well, I'm looking up the Koppenberg. I can only hope that someone else has to walk up there, because I've walked up there a few times. And my dream came true. They were all walking up there. It was crazy to see the front guys. Only I think they talked about only 3 managed to get it. But I don't know if Mads didn't do a little dab as well. I feel like he did. I don't think the camera went off him when he had to unclip a little bit. I don't know. I'm not going to go on record saying it, but I think only 2 got up there. What do you think?
I thought he made it over, but you may be right. He emerged over the brow of the couple of points where someone on the Koppenberg, they appear out sort of from nowhere over the brow, and he was certainly still on his bike then. I mean, Mitch, quite a lot of talk. Well, there has been some talk anyway in the last couple of days about the Koppenberg potentially being removed because it did cause so much chaos. Of course, it was removed. It didn't figure in the Tour of Flanders for a long time after the infamous edition in 1987 when Jesper Skibby got hit by a team car, didn't he? And he crashed, and then sort of pandemonium ensued. It was removed the following year, so 1988, reinstated in 2002. It also had another 1-year hiatus in 2007 and then was reinstated in 2008. It's not usually, well, as decisive as it was at the weekend, but just in terms of its presence or not in the race, what are your feelings?
Definitely got to stay there. There's something so cool about it. It's a little bit like Roubaix and Arenberg, you know, only in that one race you get that iconic sector. And it's just, it adds something extra to the race. And you could really compare it to Arenberg, actually, because it's so different to everything else in Flanders. It's got some of the roughest cobbles, if not the roughest cobbles in Flanders. The steep sector of it, the fact that you're down in that little, almost like a tunnel, you drop down so far, there's no crowd there. They're sort of above you on the hill as you cut through. And there is are you not going to be able to pedal the whole way up? Like the front guys often get up there, but back where I used to be, if someone, you know, pauses or doesn't, you know, keep the momentum and you're just stuck on the wheel, it's so steep that you often have to unclip and walk. Once you get to 0K an hour on there, you can't re-accelerate. I've walked up there probably 2 or 3 times, and it is what it is. And I don't know, I think it is quite decisive, even though it wasn't, I don't think, maybe it's not as decisive as this year, but often you see the wheels coming off on that point. And the fact that they go straight into sort of the Stationsberg afterwards, straight into the Tyrannberg, it's just bang, bang, bang. It's a really, you can hear from my voice, the climb needs to stay there, because otherwise we're just going to be looping around the Paterberg and the Gold Quarum on another lap. I don't know if we need to do that again. Like, it's iconic. It's got to stay there. It's so like great.
It's like a dormant volcano, isn't it? It's like, it doesn't decide the race every year. But every now and again, you get a bit of rain, you get the leaves on it, you get that grime, and it's like, hello, here I am again. I'm the Koppenberg. You'd forgotten about me, hadn't you? All you over there drinking beer in your VIP tent on the Quarmont. Well, actually, this is the place to be.
I can tell you, all the riders talk about it. We're all talking about the Koppenberg. We're all thinking like, wow, Koppenberg coming up. The Koppenberg, how are we going to go up the Koppenberg? It's like well, maybe not now. These guys are a different breed now. But back when we were, you know, a little bit weaker and a little bit softer, it was a talked about climb. It was scary. Am I? Oh, shit, we've still got the Koppenberg coming. Oh, I'm on my hands and knees. So it's got to stay.
Mitch, Robbie McEwen made an interesting point in commentary on Sunday just about the mechanics or the sort of technique of riding over the Koppenberg, and he talked about the cyclocross riders and Van der Poel having this very sort of round pedal stroke with no round, I mean that's a sort of layman's way of putting it, with no sort of dead spot, and that is really, really helpful on a climb like the Koppenberg, particularly in the wet weather. If there are any sort of kinks and wrinkles to your pedal stroke, then you will be found out on a surface like that. Is that true?
I guess so. I hadn't ever really thought of it like that. I just think that I think like a guy like Van der Poel, he's so aware of how to put the power through. And look, I probably would agree with that, thinking about it now, but doing a fair bit of mountain biking these days, it's something that I've had to relearn, is actually a smoother pedal stroke, because when you're riding up technical climbs over rocks and things like that, you can't just blast up there with power because the back wheel will just slide and you're out. So you've got to take almost the power off and control the pedal stroke throughout. So it is quite a valid comment. Whether that was a difference in that moment, I think, because then you could argue Jorgensen. Why has he got the smooth pedal stroke? Is it from his early days as a rider? You know, he's not doing cyclocross these days. So it's one way to argue it. I just think he is superior in terms of his bike handling skills, full stop.
Yeah, I mean, some riders are just smoother just naturally, aren't they, whether they've done cyclocross or not. A slight sort of counterpoint, you know, it makes me think of Tom Boonen, who never really had, not that I can recall anyway, never really had huge problems on the Koppenberg, but he was someone who you wouldn't necessarily say had the... well, he was a stomper, wasn't he? He looked like a stomper.
I think what comes down to it is the guys are just coming to that climb a little bit fresher than the others. Do you know what I mean? Like Van der Poel, he wasn't on the limit as much as the other riders. Yeah, he was more technical. That was technically, he's better. That was another element. But I think it just comes down to, when you say of a guy like Boonen, he was a better rider physically. So when he came to that point in the race, he was just that micro percent in better shape.
I thought Boonen was an ankler. I remember reading something about his approach to Roubaix cobbles and how it was all in the ankle movement. You know, he'd really flex his ankle at the bottom of the pedal stroke. And sort of, so when you did see him stomp, it was like he's pushing with his heels, but it was to get that smooth power transfer. Do you guys see that at the time? You'd see that in his style, in his riding style, wouldn't you? He'd be really like, I'm flat-footed, you know, not pointing his toes.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, that's true. Now you say it, I can remember that. But I wonder whether he trained that or was just naturally like that. You know, he did have a big seated power, Boonen, which does help you on the cobbles. You know, the fact that I saw a lot of guys getting out of the seat on the Paterberg later in the race in the wet, I was like, how are they even doing that? I can't get out of the seat in the dry on that climb. So, it's very interesting. I do think, to wrap up the Koppenberg, is that we're talking about it now. It's got to stay. Has to. Well, why not?
Another contentious point, Mitch, after the race on Sunday was Michael Matthews being disqualified for his sprint. He would have... Hang on, let me get this right. He would have finished third. Correct? Or third?
Third. Second. Yeah.
Third. Mozzato... beat him, and we'll come on to Mozzato in a bit maybe. But Mitch, in the podcast that we did on Sunday soon after the finish, I sort of suggested that it was a deserved disqualification or relegation, that he had deviated quite significantly. Having rewatched footage and rewatched the overhead footage, and also just seen other people's reactions, and also mainly the reactions of people who know better than me what constitutes a real deviation, I've slightly sort of revised that judgment. I think it's worth just reading out the rule itself and sort of highlighting how vague the rule is. Rule 2.3 6.036, riders shall be strictly forbidden to deviate from the lane they selected when launching into the sprint and in doing so endangering others. The English is slightly dicey in that rule is the first thing I noticed there. But this reminds me of when I'm watching football, for example, and you get pundits saying, well, that wasn't a foul for me, Jeff. I always think, well, mate, the first thing to establish is what constitutes a foul. Go and look at the rules. What constitutes a foul in the rules? What does it say represents a foul? So here, you've got a similar issue, I suppose, in nailing down what constitutes deviation. Is a deviation 1 meter, 2 meters? Is it all the way across the road? There were various other factors that were mentioned, I thought, probably justifiably so afterwards. The tiredness of the riders at the end of the race, and does that translate into a lesser degree of danger? Should that be taken into account? I would also point out that, you know, the rider who benefited from this, Niels Pollitt, I mean, he could sprint against Michael Matthews 50 times and he would probably win one sprint. So I didn't really detect in his comments after the finish any huge grievance. He didn't necessarily think that it was an egregious deviation from Matthews. But what was your reaction? What is your reaction now?
I think it's a little sad, and probably because it's just a bit more closer to my heart, you know, my old teammate, and I felt he was deserving of that third place for the work that he put into the race. He launched the sprint from a long way out, so it's hard to talk about where they started that sprint to where it finished. It was a long sprint. It was almost like a sprint to try and catch Betiol and Tuns. Yes, so it was like closing the gap sprint, also trying to sprint. So it was a combination of things. It was a tired at the end of the race. They were trying to close the gap in the sprint as well. And then I think Pollitt's arm in the air, because I agree with you. He was probably, you know what, whatever. Okay, I got here. I probably wasn't going to get around anyway. The fact that he threw his arm in the air in the sprint, I think that's what made the judges go and look at it. If he hadn't have thrown his arm in the sprint and just rolled through, they wouldn't have done anything about it. Because from what I understand, I don't think they put a protest in.
No, the other thing that struck me, Mitch, is that this decision was made very, very quickly.
Very quickly,
I've been at races and it's been 2 hours before this kind of decision has been made.
I don't know why they made an example of this. No protest was put in. I could be wrong here, but I don't think a protest was put in. It was done very quickly and it was almost like unnecessary, as you pointed out. No offense to Pollock, that maybe he wasn't even going to get there. He maybe wouldn't have won the sprint anyway against Matthews. So why did they choose this to make it such an example out of it? I found that quite weird. I don't think it needed to be disqualified, because exactly what you said, it wasn't a traditional sprint. It was just a slog to the line where guys often are just sort of all over the bike everywhere. You can't apply that normal sprint rule to this kind of sprint.
It's very difficult in this situation, or in situations like this, to conceive of another way, another measure that would be slightly more sort of even-handed. You know, if you were to give Matthews just a fine, for example, that doesn't really amount to justice, does it? If, you know, Niels Pollitt, if he really was impeded, then how else could the rules be kind of amended to sort of, well, take into account the compassionate element of it as well, the fact that it is a 270 kilometer race and this is a potentially career defining result, or it could have been for some riders. Relegation feels too severe, but all of the other alternatives that one could think of maybe aren't quite severe enough, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah, it's just for me, it was just a bit of taste at the end of a great race. You know, the race for second, which, you know, I've been often speaking about on my own podcast about how the race for second is suddenly very interesting. You know, some years ago, not too long ago, that no one really cared about second. Unless you won, second and third was a real disappointment. Now it's really exciting. In the last sort of, well, let's talk about almost every classic, it's been like, cool. We talked about it last week in Catalunya. The fight for second is important now. It's important to keep getting points for your team. It's important to sort of show against the rest below the superstars who is the best of the rest. And the fight for second at Flanders was super interesting, taking nothing away from Matthew Vanderpoel, because once he went away, we sort of knew he had it after the Koppenberg. So then it just, you switched. You're like, cool, let's see who can get second. And it was such an exciting race for that. And that little end to it sort of was slightly disappointing. But I really did think it was a great addition of Flanders with that little bit of rain. It added a little bit of extra for me.
Just since you mentioned second place, Mitch, Luca Mozzato is a rider who wouldn't have been in many pundits' predictions in terms of riders who were likely to win at Flanders. Interesting rider in the sense that he's really gone under the radar in Italy. As we know, as we've talked about many, many times on the podcast, Italian cycling is really in the doldrums at the moment. And here you've got a rider who has been a pro for a few years and riding, well, has always ridden for French teams, rode for B&B Hotels, and now is riding for Arkea. And, well, Mozzato, it's kind of like Pozzato without the preening, without the P for preening. And he's actually from down the road from Pippo Pozzato, near Vicenza. I was chatting this morning to his agent, Manuel Quinciato, former BMC rider who you rode against many times, Mitch. He was just talking about Mozzato. He says he's one of the most intelligent riders, tactically astute riders he's ever witnessed or ever, you know, had the good fortune to work with. Really good in the cold, the wind, and the rain, but a very modest rider as well. And it was interesting reading his comments after the race, Mozzato. There was no sort of hint of, well, this is a stepping stone for me to, you know, potentially try and win Flanders in the future. He'd spent most of the race, and this comes back to what you were saying, Mitch, about second being important. And you know, a lot of riders who started on Sunday won't have been thinking about beating Mathieu van der Poel. They'll have been thinking possibly that a top 10 would be fantastic. And Mozzato was actually cut adrift on the first time up the Oda Quaramont, and he said he was chasing for about 40 kilometers behind, probably with that in mind, that, you know, getting a top 10 might still be possible, and that might be a fantastic result. And that's what happened. And, you know, just to sort of underline what I said about him being a very modest rider, he didn't even ride Milan San Remo. You know, an Italian rider, sprinter, fast finisher, didn't ride Milan San Remo because he didn't think that he had a chance of winning. And that day he was running in Belgium at the Coxsider Classic instead, and he won that race. So it's going to be interesting to see how he sort of develops over the next couple of years, and no longer flying under the radar, I would suggest. Mitch, you wanted to mention Movistar as well. Not a team we often mention in connection with Flanders, after Flanders, but you thought they deserved a mention.
I did. I really did. And Ivan Garcia Cortina, he's a guy that I know loves the classics, and a guy I thought would have broken through and had a sort of a big victory in the classics before now. He's shown some really good stuff in gritty races, you know, like Paris-Nice. And I saw some really great things from him in the peloton that maybe didn't feature in the races when we were racing together, you know, making front groups and hard splits and things like that. I'm like, God, this guy is really going to show something. And he sort of came through at Flanders. He had a great ride and was the first victim of the Koppenberg. I would have loved to have seen what would have happened if he did happen to ride over there and go later on. He was deserved of a better result than he ended up with, I think. But for me also, Lazcano, he has just looked fantastic in this whole classics and just attacking and just with the confidence. I looked at the team and I thought, what's changed here apart from the ability? Because, you know, Garcia's been around, like I said, he's been going really well the last few years. I think it's got a lot maybe to do with Jorgen Roelands being the director sportif in that team. A Belgian, third in Flanders himself back in 2013. You know, he's a Flanderian. So he's got to have a lot of influence on that. He's probably installed, and I don't know this, I'm only assuming this, he's probably installed that love, that passion that you need for these races. It's not just about the ability. You've got to understand where to be. You've got to understand. You've got to love it. I know we say this sort of all the time. You've got to love Roubaix to do it. You do. You've got to love the classics to do them, to come back and do it. Because we've seen there are a lot of guys who are good at the classics, but they don't love it, so they never really feature or they never come back. So I think it's got to come down to him. And we're seeing Spanish classics riders come back into it. ever since, you know, the last one I can think of is the very famous Juan Antonio Fletcher. There's been no one else really since, you know, Aviti a little bit, but Movistar in the classics, it's exciting to see.
Lazcano on the Koppenberg, Mitch. I don't know what happened to him. I think whatever happened to Ivan Garcia Cortina, which we saw, because he was at the head of the race, and we saw him have to dismount and struggle to clip back in and get going again. I think whatever happened to Lazcano was even more... it penalised him even more, because he was in really good shape coming into the Koppenberg, and then I think he finished 11 minutes down in the end. So I'm not entirely sure what happened, but as you say, it was a fine performance by Movistar, all things considered, not one we expected. Chaps, what else caught your eye?
Look, one thing that really caught my eye was Visma kicking off so early. I mentioned it on the Wolfenberg, a fantastic ride by Jorgensen and also Tish Benoot. At a point there, they also had Dylan van Baal, who was sort of doing the old Stijn de Volder ride. And if anyone doesn't know what I'm talking about, it means Stijn de Volder used to ride in the worst possible position in the peloton. He would sit last wheel back with me when I was getting dropped, except he wouldn't get dropped. He would just continually ride through the bunch. You get to the bus at the end of the race, you think, oh, I wonder how old de Volder went. He was probably dropped just after me. What the hell? He was top 10. How's that even possible? He would just ride through the bunch. So van Baal, I saw him many times at the back, and next thing I'd see him at the front. So hard to do. I can't tell you how hard that actually is to do. But those guys clearly had a plan to isolate Van der Poel and just put it down early. It was a shame that it didn't work out. I think it sort of did work in the end, because Van der Poel was isolated eventually. But Van der Poel, I read some comments from Jorgensen, and he said, you know what, Van der Poel was smart. He waited for his team. He used his team. He didn't panic. And he did. The only one time I saw him semi-panic was when his team ran out of legs and he jumped across on the Valkenburg to get across to that group with with van Baal, Tish Benoot, that looked like it was going away. Apart from that, he was very calm. And even I made the comment in commentary that I don't think he's on today. He's not looking quite as good. But that was the calmness. That was him, which we haven't seen in the other races. He was going on the front foot. You know, think about Gent-Wevelgem, think about E3. He was on the front foot. He was attacking early. Quite the opposite in Tour of Flanders. He let the teams try and attack him, try and isolate him. He used his team perfectly. And then, obviously, we saw what happened at the end. So, yeah, interesting tactic there by Visma Lisa Bike, without Wout van Aert. They really went forward and tried something new, which didn't work out in the end, but it made a super exciting race. And I think from reading the comments and hearing the interviews, they made a lot of enemies out there, because it was a super, super hard race. Everyone was complaining with still about 50K to go.
Yeah, whether it was the most exciting or suspenseful spectacle we'd seen, I mean, it was certainly a very hard race. I think it was probably colder than we realised as well. L'Equipe gave it 4 stars. They called it an édition dantesque, sort of epic edition. A lot of talk about Van der Poel as well. And what next? We should pay a short visit to Corrections Corner, because Richard, I wrongly corrected you on Sunday. You said Eddy Merckx had won Flanders twice, and I said he'd won it 3 times. And it's not like I've written a book about Eddy Merckx or anything. I really should have known that. But you know, comparisons, sort of these extravagant comparisons with the, you know, the greats of the sport following Van der Poel's 3rd Flanders win. A lot of talk as well in the press about what next, whether he now can win Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which Merckx did. I'm sure I'm right. Insane.
I think you're safe. 75. You're safe there with. Hey. Yeah, of course he won.
In the same year.
Yeah, with the rainbow jersey, if I'm not mistaken, but I might be wrong about that. Anything else, chaps? Sudal Quickstep, described in also in L'Equipe as being more like a pack of chihuahuas than a wolf pack.
Is that the, that'll be the new, the new name, will it? Chihuahua pack.
Yeah, they've got they've got a podcast.
What does
a
Chihuahua do?
Howls. I don't think it'll be Chihuahua squeak. Do they? Squeal.
They yap. That annoying yap.
Wait to be corrected next week on that. I think from Chihuahua experts writing in.
I found it interesting to go back. It's mainly a very small point, was Jaco Alula's plan, which we don't often see, was to go on the breakaway from the start. A good friend of mine, Luke Durbridge, being the first to attack, which surprised me. A guy who's actually finished 12th in Flanders himself, a good classics rider, someone who can feature later in the race, I thought would have been a right-hand man for Michael Matthews. But they went with the tactic, let's get guys up the road to support Matthews later on. That didn't actually work, because when Matthews and the group caught them, those guys had spent so much energy that they just all got spat. It's a difficult one when you're trying to play that role. There was no sort of in-between attack. I call it the pre-final attack. You've got the early break, and then you've got almost like a secondary attack going with 100K to go. Nothing sort of happened like that. So that just shows me, once again, the racing was really on. That gap never went over 4 minutes. And those guys spent a lot of energy out there. Even the Chihuahuas, the Chihuahua pack put one up there, which was interesting. So it's good to see them yapping.
We're merely phrasing what a distinguished, venerated publication like L'Equipe said. Their words, not ours. They shoot the messenger, Patrick. I was looking back at some old comments. I was trying to, as always, as every week, come up with a tenuous offbeat introduction for today's podcast. And I was looking at sort of what happened 20 years ago this week and what happened 10 years ago. And I did come across some comments from Patrick Lefebvre after it was a time trial in 3 days of Dapana in 2004. And Laszlo Bodrogi won it. And he was accused by the Rabobank team of being towed by a tram for 3 kilometres. Is there a tram that used to run up alongside the Dapana time trial?
Yeah, if you get a crosswind, it can actually really help you if you time it right. Yes, sorry, go on.
So Bodrogi was towed by the tram, allegedly, according to the Rabobank team, and Lefebvre said, oh, the Dutch are always bad losers, huh? I don't know what Patrick was saying
What was really good to see, and like thinking about Mozzato and thinking about my comments about naivety or not, is that it'd be very easy with a rider like Van der Poel to race for second. And I think what we did see from Visma and from Trek is that even though they were depleted, they weren't at their strongest, they were still racing for the win. And I kind of like that. I think it would be easy for them under the circumstances to have sort of thrown in the towel a little bit, played it conservatively, played it defensively. If Van der Poel rides away, well, you know, seconds in the bag. And I think, you know, we saw like Pedersen was still on a good day. He had a lot in him. And had he played the Mozzato card, you know, maybe he'd have been up there at the end. But I think, I don't know, I kind of want to give them credit for that. I want to give them credit for gambling. And it didn't work out. It didn't pay off. But I don't know, maybe there need to be some more sort of underhand conversations at the hotel room the night before to sort of work together. I don't know. I'm not sure if I'd seen any evidence of that in the race, like Lidl working with Visma or, you know, a sort of collaborative effort from some of the teams with interest in beating Van der Poel. But maybe we might see some of that at Roubaix. I don't know.
I 100% agree with you. I think that is a really, really good point. And maybe I didn't stress that enough when I was talking about Visma. But that's exactly right. How do we beat this guy? They went about it the right way. Because actually, Van der Poel won the race. Yeah, sure. And you can say whatever you want now. But he was on his hands and knees the last 5K. If the race had been 5K longer, 1K longer, I would have won. All this sort of comment. But, you know, I think if things had been different on the Koppenberg, it wasn't as wet, and they really did race those last few climbs, it would have been a completely different race. Of course, you can easily say that now, but they went about it the right way, and they weren't too far off, you know, unraveling him. So, yeah, 100%. You've got to give credit where it's due, and there were some amazing rides by those teams to try and defeat them.
Well, chaps, one monument in Holy Week down, one to come, Paris-Roubaix at the weekend. Your favourite race, Mitch. And we've got Skelderprijs. Have we got Skelderprijs tomorrow in between?
Yep.
I always forget whether... Yes, we have. We have. And then it is the big one, or the next big one, at the weekend. Paris-Roubaix, Mitch. Mathieu van der Poel obviously has to be the main favourite now. Former winner, of course. Wout van Aert not there. Who can we see beating him? How can we see anyone beating him, Mitch?
Yeah, it's a hard one because you've also got Philipsen as well, who is looking really good. He was riding very well there in support on the weekend, and we already know what he can do at Roubaix on the podium there last year. So, look, I like Pedersen, Mads. He showed some really, we spoke about it, he showed some great form in Flanders, what he did. Kung, this race suits him better, and he was looking great considering he crashed. He was standing on the side of the road, and he featured at the end as well. Niels Pollitt, we've seen him second in 2.19. He's second in Umlaut, seventh in E3, third at Flanders. The form is clearly there. This race suits him better than Flanders. And Van Baal, obviously winner. And like I said to you, he's got the form. I know people are writing him off. I don't know why. He just didn't look quite right in the earlier races. Maybe sickness. I don't know what the story is there. But he showed me enough at Flanders that he's there. And he's got the connection with Roubaix. I spoke about it before. You've got to love the race. You've got to have the connection. He's got that. I want to see what happens with Laporte coming back in. If he comes back in, if he's well enough. There is rumour that he will be riding. That if he can bring the extra sort of spice that Visma maybe have missed at Flanders, and being a Frenchie, you know, he's going to have that love for the race himself too. So, look, I don't know if he is riding. I did read that he was back on the start list, so I could be wrong. But the route, from what I saw, is slightly changed. 29 sectors, 55.7 kilometres of cobbles this year, 3.2K more than last year, which doesn't sound like a lot, but that's like an entire whole sector if you want to break it up like that. But when it gets important, Arenberg is sector 19 that counts down, so 18 to go afterwards. The last 18 sectors are exactly the same as the years before. So it's all in the beginning, just to sort of change things up when the whole race is getting whittled down and that sort of thing. But after Arenberg, it'll be the traditional run-in, which is going to be fun. It's Christmas. It's just around the corner.
Mitch, some people on social media in particular talk about the likelihood, the prospect of a wet Roubaix particularly as being like Christmas. I tend to prefer it when it's dry, just as a spectacle. I prefer the dusty fast ones rather than the muddy sloppy ones. But it is, the forecast is looking a bit mixed for the next few days in northern France. Bit of rain on most days this week, and currently rain forecast for Sunday, although pretty warm temperatures, 17 degrees. Mitch, I was just curious, maybe we've talked about this before, but your week, this week before Roubaix, take us back into your mind, into your body in this week. Rituals, superstitions, anxieties, insecurities.
Well, look, I never really got as connected to Flanders earlier in my career as a lot of guys do. And Flanders for me wasn't a race I had to finish. If I'd done my job and I'd done my thing, I was like, cool, I'm out. I'm all in for Roubaix. I was always thinking about Roubaix. So I would do what I need to do at Flanders and then start switching my mind to Roubaix. I was a little bit different to a lot of other guys as well because I only did Scheldeprijs once in my career. Sort of in the middle of my career, I hooked up with a teammate of mine, Jens Kukeler, and we sort of had a conversation going, why are we only reconning Roubaix on the Thursday or the Friday and doing a pretty crappy minuscule recon, testing tires, maybe doing, you know, 3-4 sectors, and then that's it? Well, I said, why don't we just actually do a proper recon? So him and I used to leave on the Monday, we drive down and we do a full recon on the Tuesday or Wednesday behind a motorbike. Because often when you do these recons with a team, you're doing them at a pretty crap speed. You're already racing each other. It's not the same. When you do it behind a motorbike, you got that race sensation. So we would do the whole of Roubaix practically, not the first 100K, but we would probably do of the sort of 29 sectors, we might do 20 of the sectors. Behind a motorbike, get a pretty big day in and you'd feel that fatigue. You'd test the equipment at the same as the race, not just 3 or 4 sectors when you're fresh and popping around and, you know, whatever. We'd test it when you're sort of 20 sectors deep. You're like, yeah, I actually need to change the pressure. That is the biggest thing at Roubaix, the tire pressure. That's the thing that's going to allow you to absorb the cobbles, ride it fast across the cobbles, but it's that balance between the cobbles and the roads. If you got too soft and you feel great on the cobbles, you're too slow on the roads. You're too hard. You're fast on the roads. You're bouncing all over the place on the cobbles. So everyone's trying to find that pressure for themselves, what works best for them. And that's what that recon is all about. We do that recon on Wednesday. We'd have a day off recovering, and then we'd meet the team for a Friday. We'd get involved in that short team recon. On Saturday, we do just an obligatory sort of, you know, leg flush, something like that. We'd go down and do this cool presentation in Compiègne where you're there and you're like, it's happened. We're here. Nothing can go wrong now. Tomorrow is Christmas. You're wrapping all your presents up, putting them under the tree. You do that presentation
I've got a question for you, Mitch. Because I think I kind of feel the same about Roubaix in that, like, I mean, literally this year, Flanders was Easter, Roubaix is Christmas, and objectively they're quite similar on the outside, like cobbled races, similar length, similar contenders, but there's a really fundamental difference. And I was thinking about this quite a lot over the last few days after Flanders, but I can appreciate Flanders and I can enjoy it, but I don't love it like I love Roubaix. And I wonder why that is for you. Is it right? What is that difference?
There's a few things for me. I think for some reason it suited me better. So I always sort of felt more comfortable in the race. Flanders, I was always like waiting for the next climb to get dropped. Whereas in Roubaix, I felt like I could actually get to the cobbles and move forward. You know, opposed to Flanders, I'd just get to the sector and only move back. That was a nice feeling that I sort of found a race like, oh, I can actually challenge in this. I can follow. I'm not just getting my head kicked in. That was a nice thing. I think it's nice after being riding around Flanders in a spider web for the last 2 weeks, you're actually going point to point. That's quite a nice feeling. Every sector you tick off, you're moving closer to the velodrome. Something about that velodrome that you finish there is this massive crescendo to the end of the race. But not only that, it's a crescendo, it's a finish to the classics. You're closing off the classics. And this is something that really cracked me at the end was, you'd get to Roubaix, my favorite race of the year, and actually you'd be on the bus going, you know, in 6 hours, I'm going to be get the hell out of here and I'm going to be finally done with the classics. You're happy to have it done. Like, it's a drain. So the key to the end of my career was trying to arrive at Roubaix feeling excited still, because you are on your tether, you're over it, you want it to be done. So there is a really sort of draw to that velodrome that it's done, I've made it, it's over, the classics, they're over for another year. We've done it, we've made it. So, and it's so hard to get to that bloody velodrome. You can't underestimate that. Sometimes you just can't make it. Physically, punches, crashes, you just don't get there. So actually arriving there sometimes feels like a little bit of an achievement in itself. The classics are done, I've got Roubaix done. So it's, I don't know, that's for me what sort of built up, made it so cool.
It's like there's a quality of madness, isn't there, to Roubaix that Flanders doesn't have. Flanders is, I don't know, it's steeped in culture, it's steeped in history, it's so much a product of the region, and it's like it's a big economic thing, evidently. Roubaix's just kind of got that insanity about it. You know, it doesn't really follow logic or sensibility. You know, you kind of look at it objectively and you're like, why is this a thing? Why are we going here? Why are we making riders do this? Why do riders want to do this? And I think there's something kind of quite unique about that in the calendar.
Is it also because we only ride those cobbles once a year? You know, maybe,
yeah, it could be
without the tour. You know, like your Flandern races, we do, apart from the Koppenberg, we do those climbs, you know, two or three times in those races, and they might feature in an Eco Tour or Bing Bank or whatever the hell that race is called now. You know, they feature every so often in other races. So that's, I think, also what adds to the Roubaix cobbles. You got one time a year to do them, and that's it. So that's quite cool too.
Mitch, thinking about, I mentioned insecurities, fears going into Roubaix. Of the two, Flanders and Roubaix, which one is easier to or can you wing either of them to an extent? If your preparation in any given year hadn't been quite right, can you to a certain extent, can things just fall in your favour and you can kind of get through either of these races? Can you wing them to any extent?
I think Roubaix is probably, I hate to say this, easier to win. Maybe that's not the right word. But we do see riders who aren't the big superstars, let's say that, win it every so often, which also adds to the cool thing of Route Roubaix. You know, you see your Van Summerens, with all respect, you see your Haymans, you know, guys who are sort of that second tier, the workers, the super domestiques, they get their chance on an off year. That's not because it's, you know, the race is any easier. It's just because of the way that the race plays out. Flanders, I think, is just, it's so hard, those climbs. You really only get the absolute cream at the top, which in a way somehow makes it boring for me. Like, because it's great what they do, these guys, and what Vanderpoel did on the weekend. It's hard, but it's sort of harder to relate to. I sort of like Roubaix, and that's what kept me coming back. I'm like, you know, I could actually win this race. If things go right and I play my cards right, I have an amazing day, don't get me wrong. That's just what kept me coming back. I can win this bloody race. Flanders, I was like, you know what? Unless I actually change bodies, that ain't happening. That race is just way too hard.
Yeah, kind of like the Grand National in horse racing in the UK. There have been some bizarre results in that. You know, 200-1 shots winning. Foynaven is a very famous one in the 50s or 60s. Mitch, very last thing on this. Mathieu van der Poel, well, I just asked you about the week between the two races. Mathieu van der Poel's sodded off to Spain.
I know. I'm struggling. Maybe you guys can help me understand this. My old friend Luke Durbridge, he's also gone back home in this week, which is something new. He's also got a newly born child, 3-month-old, I think. So I think maybe it's more family reasons for him. But yeah, and he obviously lives back in Andorra. So it's a big travel to go back there for just that week. I'm wondering why he's doing it. Is it for the weather? I knew what I actually thought about it. He could be just escaping, pressure. He can get back. He can do his normal thing. He can ride the normal roads. And people down in Calpe are just going to go, oh, look, there's just another rider in a white jersey with some stripes around it. Yeah, good on him. Whereas maybe if he's going training around where he lives, maybe you just get hounded and he can't concentrate on what he needs to do. So it could be a double-pronged thing, get some good weather and get a bit of breathing space.
I mean, we were talking off mic, weren't we, about the comparison with Boonen. How many race days was it when Boonen won in 2012?
32 yeah. days of racing before winning the Tour of Flanders in 2012 compared to Van der Poel's 3.
And we've seen Van der Poel doesn't need racing in his legs. He went straight from training camp, straight from winter into San Remo. And then he didn't race Dwars door Vlaanderen, probably quite sensibly in the end. Comes out flying in Flanders. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Do you think he's flying budget, Vueling, or economy? Or is he maybe...
Well, I hope he's not, because if he is, he's probably won't have a bike between...
His bike will be in Friday. Somewhere in Sofia or somewhere, I don't know.
Yeah, he'll be running on the treadmill. So there's some hope.
I dare say he's got a training bike already down there.
Chaps, let's move countries. Let's move contexts. Let's move from one day racing to stage racing. The Tour of the Basque Country started yesterday with victory for Primoz Roglic, despite that impromptu detour in the closing meters of that first day time trial. Tour of the Basque Country, huge, huge race in that part of the world, northern Spain. Huge, huge race for the local team, Euskaltel, Euskadi, which of course was relaunched in 2018. It was an institution in the peloton for many years before that, up until, well, between 1994 and 2012. It sort of relaunched in 2018 in a different guise and with sort of, well, with different, a slightly different philosophy, much of the same DNA. But they no longer have a rule, a sort of self-imposed rule, much like, for example, the Athletic Bilbao football team, of only having Basque members, Basque riders, riders who have come through the Basque system or their own system. The first incarnation of the Euskaltel team had three non-Spanish riders in their history. Chaps, can you remember any of them, who they were? But they were, they had a link with the Basque
Country.
One was
from the French Basque Country, wasn't he? Who's the French guy?
There were two French guys. Thierry Elissalde, or Elissalde from Bayonne, was the first ever, and that was in the 90s. The second one was the 2009 under 23 world champion Romain Sicard, who turned pro.
And the third one, Samu Sanchez. He was from Asturias,
he was Spanish.
Ah, okay, he was Spanish.
He was Spanish. Yeah, went through the Basque system. The third one was a Venezuelan, Unai Echevarria,
Basque
Durango
surname, Echevarria.
Yeah. So that was the first incarnation of Euskaltel. As I said, that ended in 2012. That team, new team, same name, and now they have, they've had various riders who have not grown up in the Basque Country and in the Basque sort of feeder team. One of them is a Kiwi. His name's James Fouché. Richard, you spoke to him a few days ago about the experience of riding for Euskaltel, Euskadi, and why he's there, how he ended up there.
So James, what I really want to ask you about is, well, I saw the start, at the start of the year, you see the team list come out and Euskaltel, Euskadi, Basque team, and it's 100% Spanish, except for a little Kiwi flag in there popped up. One New Zealander on the Basque team. Well, a team that's been known for cultivating Basque riders and also sort of being a bastion of Basque cycling, really. I mean, how did that come about? How did that move happen?
Last year, Bolton Equities stopped, unfortunately. And so it lifted 20 of us with our contract, I think. So that wasn't too good. And so we all had to sort of start looking for rides and what the future was going to be like for all of us. But it came about pretty late, but through a few contacts, my director Frankie van Hasselbroek, he was good friends with the director on Euskaltel, Peo, and so I think the connection sparked out there.
Bolton Equities was sort of the premier New Zealand, was it Pro Conti team? Mm-hmm. Sort of, and quite a list of, you know, some of the biggest riders in New Zealand cycling, at least, were on there. But that finished quite abruptly at the end of last year.
Yeah, we found out halfway through September. So I think over half of us were on 2-year deals, which went through this year as well, like myself. So we weren't really looking for another team in the future. So to be told in September was a bit annoying, but yeah, I guess there's nothing you can do. Yeah, I've been watching cycling for a long time, so I knew them from back in the day, like Sammy Sanchez, and when he was the Olympic champion, had the gold with the orange. It was pretty iconic. You see them on the side of the road everywhere. All the best supporters, which is great, and they colour the mountains of the Pyrenees. So, I was grateful to get in contact with them, and I'm stoked to be riding for them. They've been great so far this year. They've been really friendly. I'm trying my best at learning Spanish. I've been taking lessons. I haven't learned Basque yet, but
you got any phrases or vocab that you have picked up?
I'm just learning the basics at the moment. So, it's been good. I think, they've been really good. It's obviously at the dinner tables is all Spanish and stuff. So I guess listening to that every night, it will be good. It's good for my, it can only do good for my learning. And yeah, I reckon in a month or two, I'll be joining in.
Well, Richard, that was intriguing. I found myself thinking of what a sort of, well, what an exciting week it's going to be for him, because this is a huge deal for that team. I mean, they have a, they present the team outside the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao every year before the Tour of the Basque Country. They have a pre-selection of 12 riders, which they announce. Then they pick the final seven for the Itzulia itself, the Tour of the Basque Country itself. They have this Marea Naranja concept of this orange sea of fans. Of course, they hand out these orange T-shirts to all of the fans every day on the race. And, well, James Fouché is going to... Fouché, Richard? We give him a proper, the proper sort of French pronunciation? It's a French name.
Yeah. I didn't actually ask him how you pronounce it, but yeah, you'd think the EQ on there.
Yeah, he's going to experience all of that this week.
Yeah, have you been to the to an athletic club match, Daniel, in Bilbao?
Sorry, the derby.
No, just in the San Mamés, the athletic club. You know, you mentioned the
stadium,
the football team.
Yeah.
Because there's something, I was lucky enough to go last summer. I mean, the football was sort of terrible, actually, disappointingly so. But it was an experience of this team that is selecting exclusively Basque footballers. And sort of the atmosphere and the sense of something in there. And it's difficult to put your finger on what it is. I've actually been reading a book lately. I'm gonna quote from it. It's called The Basque History of the World.
Oh, it's a great book. Yeah, it's a great book.
Have you read it? Yeah. I mean, obviously, it is quite Ron Seal. There's a lot of history in there. But from the start of that, it's by a chap called Mark Kurlansky. And he writes, "We live in an age of vanishing cultures, perhaps even vanishing nations. To be a Frenchman, to be an American is a limited notion. Educated people do not practice local customs or eat local food. Products are flown around the world. We're losing diversity, but gaining harmony. But the Basques are determined not to lose or to lose nothing that is theirs while still embracing the times. They've never been a quaint people and have managed to be neither backward nor assimilated." And there's, I don't know, to me that kind of sums it up. There's a really like captivating sense of identity and uniqueness that you get in the Basque Country. The cycling team is just a part of that, whether it's, you know, the clothing, the berets, the food. I mean, San Sebastian, obviously one of the world's sort of gourmet capitals, isn't it? But, or the football team. I don't know, it's hard not to be seduced by that when you're there. It sort of seeps into you when you spend time in the Basque Country. And I think the bike race is just a kind of, you know, it's just one part of that, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. I mean, so I spent about a month there before the Tour de France last year. And yeah, it's imbued with this sense of, well, as you say, this sort of mystery and mythology that the Basques themselves also like to kind of cultivate and transmit. They know that people are captivated by this notion of this ancient people whose origins are, again, shrouded in mystery, a language that doesn't seem to have any relationship with other languages in Europe or indeed anywhere else in the world, and they revel in that. And well, it finds another outlet in bike racing, doesn't it? And it was fantastic to see the crowds yesterday in Irun at the start of the Tour of the Basque Country, many of them wearing those orange t-shirts. And it's been a bit of a theme, actually. Well, a theme, there have been two examples this year, Catalunya and the Basque Country, of a lot of people turning out on the roadside for Spanish races, which is, well, it's heartening, because we often say that cycling isn't what it was in old Europe, certainly in places like Italy, but in Spain, still a lot of people coming out to support bike races and get very, not only stand there and watch and applaud, but get quite sort of het up and excited about bike racing, which is great. Mitch, did you used to enjoy racing in Spain?
Yeah, I did. And there's bugger all races in Spain. I did bugger all races in Spain because the races don't suit me at all. I did the Vuelta, actually. I did the Vuelta 7 times, and I loved that race. I loved it because of the weather, because of the people, the Basque. Being in the Basque Country, it made me think I chose wrongly living in Catalonia. The Basque people were just that much more warmer and inviting, and I always loved it there. And actually, at the my last year when I was racing, I was living in Girona, and I went down. I wasn't racing the classics. I don't know why I was there. I wasn't racing Flanders, so I was there for Catalunya, and I went down and watched the time trial of Catalunya. It was cool. It was really cool, and the, exactly what you said. It was packed. It was right. I was up near Banyoles, not too far from Girona. I took my son up there, and it was super packed and passionate. And yeah, the some of the best, you know, racing all over Europe. I'll take this back. I was going to say some of the best crowd, but every crowd is different in every country, and they provide a different element. The Spanish, so much passion when you're going up those steep climbs, and the Basque, and yeah, it's bloody amazing racing. The Vuelta. The Vuelta was an amazing race for that.
I mean, in comparison to, well, this is something that has come out of the Tour of Flanders. Did you see a few incidents of spectators on the Quarmont chucking beer at Vanderpool? I think I read a story or saw a headline about that. Flanders Classics, the organisers sort of looking for help identifying them. And my point really is that Spanish fans do tend to be pretty respectful. They kind of understand racing, don't they? I think cycling is imbued in the culture, but it, you know, not like it isn't in Belgium, but you know, it's much less sort of in your face than it is in, well, certainly than the Tour, but you know, compared to the classics as well.
I never experienced anything like that in Belgium. Nothing other than just like crazy fans loving it up the Quarmont. And you know, we've seen that in the cross races now with Vanderpool. I don't know whether that's stemming across from that and him being, you know, Dutch, and them just having this sort of hatred against the Dutchies or something like that. I don't know what it is, but often what you find with the Tour of Flanders, I did notice that, was you do get a lot of people who aren't pure cycling fans watching that race. I do the comparison a lot to the spring racing carnival here in Australia, which is the horse racing carnival, where you've got the Melbourne Cup, you've got the Oaks Day, and the Derby Day, and all this sort of stuff in 2 week period. Very similar to that classics, cobblestone classics period in Belgium, is that everyone starts talking about horse racing for 2 weeks. People who don't give a shit about horse racing, myself included. Oh, who are you going to put on for the cup? And all this sort of, you're an expert. You know, and the next week rolls on, there's another great race on. I wouldn't even know about it. And that's the same a bit in Belgium. When you get around there and suddenly people are noticing who you are, and then you get that back there for the Eneco Tour, or Bing Bank, whatever it's called, and people don't even care about you. And you're like, yeah, but it's still like great races. This is like still on the cobblestones and all that. They're like, what? You're a cyclist. What are you talking about? So that's funny that a whole new crowd gets involved. And I think it's just a lot of drunk sort of uni students and that sort of thing. Just go, yeah, let's go down. Let's go in these tents. Dad's got me a ticket in the corporate tent. Let's just get free piss and, you know, watch some racing. There's not that real connection like you get with the Basque fans that are coming out because they love it.
All of our Gen Z listeners are turning off right now.
Free piss. That's no way to talk about Heineken. Mitch, Richard, I think that's about it. We will watch the rest of the Tour of the Basque Country with great interest. Talking about Roubaix, obviously. One other thing, a tip. I'm very intrigued to watch Josh Tarling in Paris-Roubaix. I think he might surprise a few people. Ineos are struggling, though. They've had two wins so far this season. They celebrated, I mean, much fanfare the other day, a few days ago, a week or so ago. They celebrated their 500th win. It was Pauline Ferrand-Prévot who took their 500th win. And they're stuck, I think, on 500. They can't move past that. And they're not having a good time. Tom Pidcock, as mentioned earlier, he crashed out on the recon to the Basque Country. They sent Ethan Hayter off in kind of worst of the weather, or some of the worst of the weather yesterday. That didn't help him. So they are not having a particularly good time at the moment. Results not going their way. Josh Tarling, my sort of outsider for Paris-Roubaix. Just on Ineos, this week, I think we might put out an invitation, an interview that I did with the new CEO of the team, John Allott, who's also an Aussie. I spoke to John at some length about his background, how he arrived at Ineos and what he hopes to do with the team at Paris-Nice. And I think I might put that conversation out on our Kilometre Zero feed for Friends of the Podcast later this week. But chaps, we are going to enjoy Paris-Roubaix, I'm sure, and we will be hearing from you both soon, in due course, in the next few weeks. I'm not sure who's on next week. Might be a return for Lucky Larry Warbass, who's up at altitude on Mount Etna at the moment. But in anticipation of the Ardennes Classics, we might get Larry back on next week. In the meantime, thank you, Richard, and thank you, Mitch.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.